Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Five-year-old Davy was watching his favorite TV show when his mom came in and gently put her hand on his shoulder. "When the Benny Beanbag show is over, it will be time to put your toys away and wash up for dinner," she reminded him. Davy turned around as if he had been hit and began to yell, "Benny Beanbag! Benny Beanbag! Benny Beanbag!" punching the sofa pillows as hard as he could. "It's not over yet," his mother reassured him. "We don't have to turn it off until it's over." "The Benny Beanbag Show is brought to you by Teddy's Toothpaste," Davy intoned. "The very best thing for your smile. Pick up a special complimentary toothbrush from Teddy with every family-sized tube. You'll be glad you brush with Teddy." Davy's mom sighed. Davy had trouble with beginnings and endings, and she could never get him to talk directly with her about anything. Fortunately, she'd been getting him professional help since he had been diagnosed with autism. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about childhood autism? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We are fortunate to have two experts in this complex and confusing field joining us today. Dr. C.T. Gordon is a child psychiatrist in private practice and an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He has been involved in research on autism for a number of years. He's also the father of three children, one of whom is autistic. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Gordon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mrs. Edie Gordon has been homeschooling her autistic 12-year-old for 7 years. She's also the wife of Dr. Gordon and, of course, the mother of their three children. We're so glad you could join us, Mrs. Gordon.
Thank you.
Dr. Gordon, most of us have heard of autism, but could you explain a little about what it actually is?
The way that I think of autism, I think that there are four major problems. The first and foremost has to do with difficulties with communication, both the verbal aspects of communication and the nonverbal or body language aspects of communication. And kids can vary along a spectrum with this communication deficit, from very severe, that is being nonverbal and having no ability to understand language or produce language, and about 30 to 40% of autistic kids actually fall in this category, to the other end of the spectrum where they may have full language, normal language receptively and expressively, but only have difficulties with the conversational aspects of language or the pragmatic aspects of language. The second major core dimension in autism is what I call self-directedness. People with autism can have tunnel vision and rigidly pursue their own internal preoccupations without a lot of attention to what's going on around them. They can be perseverative or very repetitive in their pursuit. And this is good in a way. This is where we get perseverance, and they certainly are the epitome of that. Another way to put it in this dimension is that they have poor shared attention or joint attention. That means the ability to share or to join in with their world in a communicative way. They tend to just pursue their own line of interest. The third major dimension is difficulties in certain aspects of abstract thinking. People with autism can be very bright, but they have a lot of difficulty, particularly when it comes to pretending, when it comes to understanding abstract things like social nuances. Their social reasoning skills are impaired, for instance. And the final major problem in autism is their high degree of anxiety. There have been a couple of studies done that have looked at the presence of anxiety disorders in people with autism. And it's been found that about 85% of people with autism meet criteria for a full anxiety disorder, and probably almost 100% of them have anxiety symptomatology. There's also a much higher incidence of anxiety, obsessive compulsive behavior, which is an anxiety symptom, and depression in the family members of people with autism. So I think that that's part of the biology as well, and is an often misunderstood part of them. And a lot of the behavior that we see in autism that we can focus on, like agitation, tantrums, aggression, and self-injurious behavior, hitting oneself, biting oneself, may stem from anxiety-related symptomatology. So is some of their social difficulty. I mean, you could imagine being very anxious, being self-directed, and not being able to understand or create communication very well. That would put you at quite a disadvantage mm-hmm. socially.
How common are these conditions?
Well, until the past 10 years, the frequency of autism was assumed to be about 4 in 10,000. Over the last 10 years, there have been a number of epidemiologic studies done in the United States and Europe that show much higher rates of autism. Now, the incidence of autism is thought to be about 2 to 3 times that, or about 10 to 12 in 10,000, which is about 1 in 1,000. And the incidence of autism spectrum disorders, which would include autism, high-functioning autism or pervasive developmental disorder, or Asperger's syndrome, is thought to be about 20 in 10,000 or 1 in 500 people. So we're talking about a lot of people.
Now, is Asperger's a part of this continuum, or it's a separate thing?
It's considered to be part of the autism spectrum. That's why I include that. So the autism okay. spectrum would include both autism and Asperger's syndrome.
Mrs. Gordon, you've had some experience along part of that continuum. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
We have 3 children, as was mentioned, and our middle child, Zachary, has autism. I would say that we first noticed some difficulties with Zachary around 1 year of age. He actually turned out in the infant stage to be our easiest baby. He was very engaged. He had very good eye contact. He was very, very social. And he slept through the night relatively early, unlike our older son, Chip, who was very, very difficult. You had to rock him and, you know, to try to get him to sleep. He just needed constant attention. And the one thing I can think of, you know, comes immediately to the top of my head is he had this obsession with vacuum cleaners. And every day I had to get not one vacuum cleaner, but all 3 vacuum cleaners that we owned out several times a day. And I had to go through the mechanics of each of the vacuum cleaners. And I am a twin and one of 7 children. On the younger, we were number 5 and 6. Although I just didn't have any experience with children. I was, you know, being one of the younger ones. And I just sort of thought, well, this is par for the course. And, you know, I wasn't one who read, you know, all these books to get myself ready for being a mother and stuff. And, you know, my husband was telling me, this isn't right. This isn't normal.
You couldn't teach him to vacuum or anything while you were at it.
Well, we're talking 17 and 18 months of age.
Oh,
it
yeah,
was, he was very, very
was
young.
Hard at that point, right?
And so, you know, I sort of just went with the flow. And my husband would come home at the end of the day. And I'm like, I had to get him all out 6 times today. You know? And, you know, he was just trying to be supportive and tell me, you know, how mothering is the most difficult job in the world. And, you know, try to help me out along that perspective. So when Zachary came along, we were just so pleased. It was so exciting to have such an easy baby.
Oh, dear.
And he actually did start to develop language, I think, within the correct, you know, age range, milestones, whatever. And then shortly thereafter, I guess when he was, I say around 10 months to 12 months, we noticed little things, like he did not respond to his name. He stopped responding to his name.
Oh, but he had been.
He had been up to that point.
Oh, my gosh.
He stopped responding to his name. And of course, that was alarming. In my trainings in audiology, so people were telling me all the time, you know, you have to get his hearing checked. I think he's deaf. Well, I knew he wasn't. And one of my biggest clues was he loved Walt Disney videos. And he could be 3 rooms away in the house, and you could turn that video on, and he would come running. But then On the same token, I could walk in the room and call his name, and he would not turn. He would not even acknowledge. So that was one of the main things that I think alerted us.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about childhood autism.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors, and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon about autism in childhood. Now, about this time, we've heard stories of people who have had their kids vaccinated, you know, around that age range, and then dramatically some of these things have happened. You want to talk to that a little bit? Because a lot of people are putting those two
people
things together.
Yeah,
there's a lot of questions about this regression. And although it's not seen all the time, it's seen in a significant portion of the time, somewhere between 20 and 35% of the time, kids seem to develop normally and then really fall off and regress during the second year. And indeed, it is when they get a number of vaccines. They get their MMR, their measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and they also get their DPT booster during that time.
Which is diphtheria.
They generally occur diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. And that generally happens the MMR at 15 months and the DPT booster at 18 months, right around in the center of the regressive time. So actually, there are some big studies that are just beginning to look more closely at regression and what might be going on then. And is it a vaccine or some other environmental influence, or is it the unfolding of a genetic disorder that just happens to manifest itself at that time? We have examples of other neuropsychiatric disorders where the same thing happens. For instance, schizophrenia, which is very common and affects about 1% of the population. Many people with schizophrenia appear to be, for all intents and purposes, normal and fine until they get into adolescence. And then generally over a period of time, somewhere between 6 months and 2 years, they develop psychotic symptomatology that involves hearing voices and believing things that aren't true and so forth. And the way that that's thought about is that the genetic predisposition was there the whole time, but that the brain got itself into a state of development at that age in adolescence when it was when the symptoms were manifest, that prior to that, given the stage that of development that the brain was in, those symptoms weren't manifested. Mm-hmm. And that's a way to think about autism too and why many kids can appear normal at first and then over the second year of life seem to get much worse. It can be purely a neurodevelopmental phenomena. Remember earlier I said that the bulk of the research evidence, for instance, from examination of the brains of children and adults with autism that have died does not show any evidence for any kinds of infections or traumas. It shows evidence for a developmental problem. And there's very, very strong evidence for genetics being involved in autism. Autism is thought to be the most heritable of any neurodevelopmental disorder. And that's because in identical twins that have all the same genes, if one twin is autistic, there's about a 90% chance that the other twin will be in the autism spectrum. Hmm. Whereas in fraternal twins that share the same number of genes as the usual brother and sister, there's only a 5 to 10% risk of having autism spectrum disorder in the co-twin. So that's a huge difference, and that's what we use as our primary measure of heritability. And there's a major genetic study being launched that involves many, I should say most of the genetic groups that are studying autism in combination with the MIT Genetics Lab to really cooperatively define the genetics of autism. And this will take place over about the next 3 to 5 years.
So I want Mrs. Gordon to talk a little more about when your son was beginning to show signs of things that you were concerned about. And here you have in your house a child psychiatrist who unfortunately knows a whole lot too much about what he's seeing in his own child.
Yeah. I remember real clearly when Zach was about a year old that my husband came home and I was sort of telling him about things that I was seeing with Zach that were alarming, which also included not only did he not respond to his name, but he just seemed to be operating in a more unusual fashion. He seemed to start to be less available to others of us around him. And we had his older brother is about 17 months older. So he was, you know, he was a good playmate for him. But he just seemed to be less available for shared play. And so I remember my husband coming home and he used the A word in reference to Zachary at about that point in time, maybe a little bit older, you know. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, you know, he's at NIH and he's working with autism and it's just on the brain. It can't be possible that he's talking about Zachary because he was our, you know, our easier baby and whatnot. You know, Chip, I might understand something about Chip.
Chip with his vacuum cleaners,
Zach,
right?
You know? Right. So that was really alarming. And at that point, I was also pregnant with our third child. And so all those things sort of, you know, created a lot of anxiety for me. But we progressed, you know, we kind of went along and we did everything that we thought we could do within the scope of our household. We did not run out and start taking Zachary to professionals at that point because I was living with the professional. You know, I had a lot of confidence and probably I put a lot of confidence in him. Maybe, you know, a lot of pressure, maybe more pressure than he needed. But, you know, I felt relieved that we had the doctor of autism in the house.
What kinds of things? You said you accommodated the household. What kinds of things did you do?
Like, for example, his love of the videos. I spent more time with him watching the videos, I think. We would try to kind of use the videos as learning material. And, you know, when you talk about that these children have difficulty relating, well, that was a way that you could relate and you could get play out of. So we looked at Disney items and anything that was Disney related that he loved. And you just try to spend more time, more attention on those kind of toys, because that's how you could engage and get his interest piqued.
Yeah, I think the trouble relating is really trouble communicating. And when Zach was young, well, in fact, until he was 8 years old, he couldn't communicate in the usual way. He couldn't understand any language. We needed to learn a way to communicate with Zach because we weren't able to naturally communicate in the usual way that people do by talking.
Except at that point, he still had one-word utterances until about 18 months. And I think what happened was, you know, we were sort of seeing a slowing down, I think, in his language development. And, you know, you're talking about a relatively short period of time, month-wise, but it's a critical time. And, you know, and we had the other young toddler around the house, and I was pregnant with this other one. And I think what happened was slowly his language, those words that he had, there were less and less of them. And by the time he was about 18 months, his language dropped out completely, and that was an obvious. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Now he's not talking at all. So we were seeing some of these unusual behaviors and not, you know, responding to his name and some unusual play behaviors, but now the language is gone. The little bit that he had is now gone.
Was he showing signs of frustration at that?
Oh, definitely.
All of a sudden he was unable, not all of a sudden, but gradually he was unable to communicate.
Right. And I don't think I realized how much the receptive piece was a component, that he wasn't understanding so much of what we were saying. You just look at, oh my gosh, he's not talking, he's not talking, he's not talking.
You don't realize he's not.
And again, I didn't have any background in any of this. You know, I didn't even think about the understanding and the lack of understanding of language. I was just looking so much at the expression and lack of expression.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about childhood autism. Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon about autism.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parents Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. So this stuff about language that a child has learned, magically, it seems, goes away.
Yeah, it seems to disappear, and they're unable to access that. And I was kind of responding to your question, well, what do you do to engage him? And I think that that's a challenge for parents, particularly mm-hmm. parents who relate more verbally, because you have to get down. You have to do a lot of physical relating through touch and wrestling around and tickling. And you need to do a lot of little games and anything to keep the communication going, I think is extremely important. I think it's important for later brain development, actually, to keep the communication channels open at each stage.
Right. And I think, you know, the difficult thing with all that is you're going through such emotional turmoil yourself, and you don't want to display that and reveal that to the child, the children. But it's really hard because now you can't relate to them verbally. You have to do it nonverbally and in play, like my husband said, and you have to be up. And it's hard to be up when you're wondering what's happened to my child.
Yeah.
You know, and you sort of have that panicked, you know, fear comes
you
into
really
play.
Have
what's
going to
happen? And you start looking down the road, and it's tough.
What does happen down the road? Let's jump for a minute, just because if parents are thinking, gee, is this my child? There's, I'm sure, panic setting in. Mm-hmm. What happens to kids down the road who have autism?
Generally, kids get diagnosed with the autism somewhere between 2.5 and 4 years of age now. And that mean age is moving earlier and earlier as there's more awareness. And at that point, then the big decision is, how do you work with them? How do you stimulate them? What do you do with them educationally? And there's some difference of opinion about what exactly the best thing to do with a young child with autism is. But what's clear is that early intervention that is an adequate number of hours, and it's generally thought to need to be about 30 to 40 hours per week with a structured format that focuses on communication, would seem to be the formula that would help these kids most. And the general type of educational program that does this is called an Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA, program. This was started almost 30 years ago by Ivar Lovaas at UCLA, and is now generally thought to be the gold standard of what should be done educationally in a young child with autism. And you work on things that are predominantly related to language, because this communication piece is so critical. You work step by step by one-to-one teaching with a lot of positive reinforcement to keep the child interested and motivated. You work on better understanding of language and better expression of language, along with other age-appropriate developmental skills like play, teaching them how to play simple games, how to take turns in sort of basic interactional skills like that, like basic cutting and pasting and that kind of stuff.
So you're working on skills such as attention, imitation, self-help skills, academic skills, play
this is
skills.
All, excuse me. This is all part of the ABA mm-hmm. technique. Mm-hmm. Do you do this with your son at home?
We started Zachary in an ABA program when he was about 5.5. And the reason why we didn't start about him earlier in that is because we didn't know about it. Originally, I think Dr. Lovaas had used this kind of a teaching paradigm, I think this is accurate, in mentally retarded individuals, and then later adapted it to be used with autistic children. And he had come to the Washington, D.C. area in November when Zachary was 5 years old. And I went to his conference, and I was just amazed. And it hit me right away that this was exactly what Zachary needed. He needed this kind of teaching program. But what happened was Dr. Lovaas was explaining that they have a few of these providers that are trained in using this method of applied behavioral analysis around the country. And, of course, people were flocking and wanting this, you know, desperately to have this kind of teaching program for their children, but there weren't enough professionals to meet the need. And so we were told that, you know, probably a year's waiting list is what you were looking at. And I was sitting in the audience just devastated, thinking, a year? You know, they're telling us that we've already passed some of the critical language learning years, and now you're telling me I'm going to have to wait another year. Well, that just wasn't going to do. And so I remember going home and just saying to him, we got to work this out. We got to get him. And so we did actually get on the waiting list. And we, in the meantime, I read everything that I could and had connected with some families that were already doing this program in the area. And I sort of tapped into their resources and got a little bit of information. And we sort of tried to do what we could as we were waiting for Zachary's name to come up on the list. And we started a little bit of program ourselves, and then he was able to get started, I think, the following March.
The interesting thing about the ABA program for Zach, though, is that it was nearly a complete failure within the first couple of months because Zachary had no receptive language. And at that time, the program was totally based on a child having some receptive language. It was a receptively based program.
Unfortunately, we are out of time at this point, but we will continue on our next program, our discussion of childhood autism and Zachary's Odyssey. So join us on our next Parents Perspective. We're so grateful to have Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 160. And tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.